My name is Mike Matuzzi. I'm the host of Contemporary Spirituality. And tonight we're with Tim Dollar, local lawyer who has a fascinating story. And I've known Tim Dollar for 30 plus years and just anxious for him to tell you his story. So, Tim, if you would start out, one thing I know that's unique about your story is you're the son of a preacher's kid. If you don't mind starting there, tell us about that.
Hey, Mike. Glad to be with you. Yes, I am the son of a Protestant Baptist minister who was here in Kansas City for many, many years and pastored the Kansas City Baptist Temple, was on the ABC affiliate for about 10 years with our Sunday morning services. So from my very earliest age, that was my entire world. Every single time the doors were open, we as a family were there, and that's how I was raised.
And you're the oldest of four, and you and your dad were very close, correct?
We were very close. We had a terrific relationship. He was sort of a frustrated lawyer in the sense that I think in his heart he always wanted to be a lawyer, but felt the call of God to be a preacher instead. And humorously enough in that regard, sort of carefully pushed me to the legal profession.
Interesting. The challenges for you as a preacher's kid, tell us about that.
Well, there are a number of them. First of all, my dad was pastor of what some people would call today a megachurch. It was different than what I see today in megachurches. I mean the term megachurch only in the sense that he had a large congregation, 10,000 plus members and, attendance 30 years ago of, 4,000 or 6,000 people on Sunday morning, which was a big congregation back then. So certainly had the challenge of being in a fishbowl, the preacher's kid with that many people. There was never a single step you took, a thing you were involved in that wasn't seen by every member, and not only seen by every member, but the subject of criticism. So it at various times. That's just sort of the way you were raised. And, my father had to take special precautions, to make sure that, that I was insulated from that. But beyond that, I think the second challenge, which I think is true of almost every preacher's kid, it's a unique situation in the sense that I would go to church and sit in the pew on Sunday morning. And when I did so, I too was a parishioner. And I would then be, I think, obligated to hear a message from the pulpit, which on some level you would hope was divinely given to him. His job was to deliver spiritual truth to me on Sunday morning. And in that sense, we had this relationship. He's my pastor. But that was from, 9:30 to 10:30. And then you would come home and he was your dad. And he was just like every other dad, meaning that he had the same human missteps, failures that every single human on the planet suffers. And so there was tremendous danger and risk there of somehow meshing the two. And if you mesh the two, then you can see hypocrisy, coupled with the fact that not only that, he's running a large staff of 20 other pastors. And when you're dealing with those issues with 20 other pastors, you see those frailties as well. Because the business side of church, it's inescapable, bleeds over into family life, just like every other family and every other profession. So it was challenging, but I would say for the most part, with some failures along the way, my father worked really hard to try to separate that and insulate you from that sort of problem.
You talk about the denomination, Baptist denomination, very conservative, particularly at that time. And some of this I know just because we know each other well, the many conversations we've had over the years, but no alcohol, no dancing, even no movies would have been the norm for much of your growing up time, correct or incorrect?
So both. Correct from the standpoint that when my father took over the church, yes, very conservative denomination, and all of the things that you suggested were part of the spiritual or doctrinal culture of that congregation. My father, on the other hand, did not believe any of that and was not did not believe that that church and the denomination had been misled on those subjects. But we had long talks about it, and the issue was he could drop a bomb, or he could lead them to what he thought was the light. And I remember his phrase, hey, it takes a lot of water to turn a big ship. But it did create interesting challenges because when I was, for example, 16 or 17, and you would just be a normal teenager and want to go on a date and go to a movie, and I would have a conversation with my dad. And his answer was very interesting and I thought very helpful, because what he said was, son, there is absolutely nothing wrong with going to a movie. It's ridiculous that people think there is. My church, however, is not there yet. And so here's the deal. You're the preacher's kid. It's a large church. If you go, people will know, and I will be criticized. But I don't want you to, I don't want that to be the reason that you don't go. If you believe that the higher calling of just protecting the congregation until I could lead them to light is a good thing, then yeah, I would voluntarily say, hey, it'd be better if you wait. But I'm not going to restrict you. And in fact, here's some money. I'm going to pay for you to go if you want to go. And Mike, it just sort of took out all the, need or desire. Mike, it's I can wait till I leave home to do something like that, just out of respect for what my father was trying to do and where he was trying to lead them.
Wow. I think that was a question everybody was hoping you would. Did you go or not? That was a question folks were wanting to know. No, I understand.
I didn't, which is just an odd part of my childhood, but I didn't. And again, it helped avoid sort of rebellion, because I didn't, there wasn't a desire to go because, oh, I'm going to show you. And instead, I just said, no, listen, let's weigh importance, and that's not important.
Yes. Let's move to, I think, a somewhat related issue, again, with your father being way ahead of the congregation on racism. I understand that he integrated pretty much an all-white church in Raytown back in the 70s, maybe, but I may be wrong in the time frame. But tell us about that.
Shockingly, Mike, in 1969, when my dad took over the Kansas City Baptist Temple, it was segregated. African Americans could attend, but they could not join. My father was appalled. He thought it was unbiblical, wrong, immoral, and every other word you could attach to it.
Right.
He has kind of the same philosophy, which is I could just drop a nuclear bomb on this congregation, blow it apart, split it apart, or I could lead them to the truth. And he had an interesting plan, which I was fascinated by. We talked a lot about it when I was a young boy. He came in contact with a young African-American engineer at TWA. His name was Sam Shockley. And he took Sam to lunch, and he was very honest and open with him. He told Sam that his church was segregated. He told Sam that he thought it was wrong and immoral, and he wanted to lead the church in the right way. And he told him the choices that he faced as a pastor. And he openly said, Sam, I need to you to conspire with me to lead my church to the light. And what I want you to do is to start coming. And I'm going to slowly start to integrate you into our congregation and on the platform. I'm going to have you sing, because he was a person with a great voice. And the idea is, Sam, you have to understand that I'm willing, you have to be a willing pawn in my effort to bring these people to light. But my church will eventually fall in love with you. And that will help me. That will help me integrate this church and bring them to light. And Sam said he would. And that worked. And today, the Kansas City Baptist Temple, to my understanding, is about 75% African American.
Oh, my. So Sam was the Jackie Robinson of that church, essentially, huh?
And chairman of the deacons for something like 20 years.
Oh, my. Outstanding. All right. A little bit more on you. Son of a preacher's kid, and I think your dad was a son of a preacher's kid. So you're Generation 3, and you're the oldest. Did you consider that as a vocation ministry?
My father gave me some very, very, what I thought to be very good advice when I was a very young child. And it's counterintuitive from what you would think that a pastor would say to his son. But here's what he said. He said, son, you should do everything that you possibly humanly can to avoid the ministry. Then if God calls you, do it. And the point that he was making is this, that in his opinion, there were too many people claiming to be in the ministry that had done so for human reasons, the choice of a vocation, and not really called by God. And he thought that if you were going to be in the ministry, you needed a divine calling. You needed something intuitively that God had actually touched you to do so. And therefore, use every human power you have to avoid it. But if God still calls you, then obey God's command. And that was terrific advice for me. And I never felt that calling. And that led me to be a lawyer.
And why lawyer? Was that your first thought? That was a function, maybe your dad, a frustrated lawyer. How did you get to that? Why did that end up to be a good fit for your skill set? If you
my dad got, yeah, my dad got a secular education. He thought that divinity school didn't provide him enough of a broad spectrum of education that he thought you needed to be a good pastor. So he went to a secular university and was offered a scholarship to go to law school and turned it down because he thought he was called to the ministry. And in that sort of, I think, subconscious communication, we talked often when I was young about the law. And I think in those conversations, it brought about an interest in me to explore it more, coupled with his conversations later in life in which he said, because as a trial lawyer, that's sort of what we're doing. And he said, you know, Tim, at the end of the day, your profession and mine really isn't that much different. It's just that you're preaching on Friday to a jury, I'm preaching to a congregation on Sunday, and we're asking for a little different result.
That's excellent. That's excellent. All right, more about your life. Very successful trial lawyer. You and I went to UMKC. You graduated 1 year ahead of me, so we're 30-plus years into this. You've got a lovely wife, Debbie, who I've met, and 4 great kids. How do you, and you run your own firm, how do you balance all of that? As they have always said, the law is a jealous mistress. You know, it can be time consuming.
Well, you know, this isn't earth shattering. It's what I think is true of every profession in the secular world. It's about managing priorities and to actually insist upon balance. You're absolutely right. We all know law is a demanding profession. It is It is stressful, particularly as a trial lawyer, and therefore you have to be intentional about making sure that while you work hard, you also play hard. And that's been my motto throughout my entire career, work hard and play hard. I will confess that at the first part of my career, I sort of contrived a scenario in which, we didn't have children. My wife was working, and the first part of building your practice, I didn't succeed at that. But I transformed over the course of, 10 or 20 years into trying to maintain balance. And really, if you're not having balance, you're not serving your clients very well either, because your mind isn't clear, you're fatigued, your concentration drops off. So it's all about priority and being intentional about it.
Right. So what matters for you? You've been walking this planet 60 plus years, have all those experience from son of a preacher's kid and all of that. What words of wisdom do you have for the listeners now? What do you say matters most after 60 years on this planet?
Well, it's interesting you ask that question. Anecdotally, I sort of internally dealt with this even most recently, something I believed intuitively, but became more, I think, apparent to me. And so I'll tell you this story. Look, I love the practice of law. I get the biggest kick out of it you can possibly imagine. I can't wait to get to the office every day. It's just a kick in the pants for me. But some folks, I think, get the idea that particularly if you have had some modicum of success, kind of focus on your legacy in the profession. And that I've come to believe is chasing windmills and a myth, which leads me to the answer of what I think is most important. And here's the anecdotal story. One of my mentors in the practice of law was the legendary trial lawyer from Kansas City, Max Faust. He actually represented my father for 20 years. Anybody that's in our generation, Mike, yours and my generation of trial lawyers, know that Max Faust's name is legendary, is maybe one of the two or three trial lawyers that have ever practiced in the state of Missouri. Recently, I gathered together all of my younger lawyers, and I did so because I wanted to ask them a question. Max Faust passed away not all that long ago, and I gathered them just for lunch and in an informal setting. I said, I got a question for all of you. How many of you at this table know the name Max Faust? And Mike, I was heartbroken to hear the answer that not a single one of my young lawyers knew the name. Well, here's the point. My law practice is intrinsically daily, enormously satisfying to me intrinsically. But the collective memory of the public about whatever you've accomplished in your career is a nanosecond. And when you're put in the ground and the lights get turned out for the last time, that is a fading memory. And that means this: only one thing really matters, and that is your relationship with friends and family in connection with God. That's it. Nothing else is lasting. Nothing else is enduring. And so my focus in this last half of my life is to do a way better job of focusing on my dear friends, focusing upon my family and finding ways to enhance those relationships, to serve them, to have them spend time with me. And that not only provides the temporary enjoyment and fulfillment beyond words, but that, my friend, is lasting.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I still remember, I clerked for Max Faust, as you know, a couple of years in law school, and I still remember walking into his office one day and say, my friend, Pastor Dollar, somebody's using his name or the name of his church, and I don't think they can do that. Go research it. But that was my first encounter in a strange way to your dad and his ministry. What you said at the end, last half of life, you know, so many of our listeners, are kind of captivated by this notion of second half of life spirituality. That first half, we ascend, we get a name, we get a career, blah, blah, blah. And the second half, you know, maybe we descend, maybe we simplify, maybe we let go, so forth. I think you're saying some of that in this next stage of your life, you've called it the last stage, you look at things differently.
Yes, I want to focus on things. Of course, we all know we should have been focusing on them all along, Mike, but we're human.
Sure.
And we didn't. But so I really, really grabbed onto a couple of concepts for me personally, and it's just me. One is the notion of gratitude, which I think is a sustaining notion. And I really, really commit to the proposition of waking up every morning and the first minutes and time that my feet hit the floor, I want to be on my face before God in just gratitude. Gratitude for all of the external things that he's provided. But more simply, hey, this is another day that God has granted. We have no assurance, at least in this life, for tomorrow. And I just want to be thankful for what you have given me to be able to enjoy today. And then secondly, to really focus on that concept of, I mean, I do believe God intended us to live the quote abundant life. That doesn't mean we shouldn't sacrifice. It doesn't mean we shouldn't give or whatever, but, we need to, we need to focus on grabbing from life everything that it has to offer. After all, he gave it to us. And so I want to focus on, look, I have 24 hours a day. When I raise, I'm getting off track, but when I raised my four kids, we had a thing when they were young, and every night we had a ritual, every single night, my four kids would gather around the dinner table. And at the very earliest age they can remember. And at the dinner table, their dad, and they knew this would happen every night, required them to tell me one thing that they learned that day and one thing that made them happy. And it could be the simplest thing. I learned 2 + 2 today. I learned that I liked the color blue today. I learned whatever. Didn't matter. Didn't need to be earth shattering. Just tell me one thing you learned today. Because everybody needs to step forward every day. If you're not stepping forward, you're stepping backward. And secondly, though, they knew they had to tell their dad one thing that they enjoyed today. And it could be the simplest, most ridiculous thing. But my kids have had that ingrained in them their entire life and their entire brains. And they roll their eyes and they joke at dad about it. But I'm telling you, it's part of their DNA. And I want that to be part of my DNA. When I lay my head down every night on that pillow, Tim, God granted you another day. Here's what I enjoyed today. And part of that enjoyment, Mike, is service to others, right? You and I have talked a great deal about the quiet things that we do that nobody ever should know about, right? But we do just because it does bring us Joy. I remember a conversation you and I had about just, you know, little things that, that we do. And I know you do a lot of it. But I never forget, you know, just being in a grocery line one time, paying for somebody's groceries, don't have any idea what their deal is. And I remember the lady turning to me and saying, hey, I don't need that. And I looked at her and I said, well, then you misunderstand, my dear. I didn't do it for you. I did it for me.
I love that. And I remember you telling me that, and I've used that. And Tom Turner, John Turner, local lawyer's brother, has kind of another similar spin on it, that, you know, we need the poor. It's not that they need us. We need the poor. There are teachers, and I like that very much as well. Tell me a little bit about you and the divine, kind of more the vertical relationship of the cross. I get the family and friends and connecting horizontally. Where do you find God? How do you find God? Scripture reading, quiet prayer, nature. What speaks to you the most? All of the above, or what would you say to that?
Well, let me first confess that my notions these days are much less rigid than they were growing up, right? We all know the psychological principle of what you were first told is, you know, or what you first believe is what you will always believe. And there's certainly truth in that. And despite the fact that my father was quite the progressive, he was a progressive in a conservative denomination. And so that's relative. Right. And so, you know, some of those notions I have questioned. But here's what I would say today. I was burdened in my earlier spiritual journey by the legal training that we have. Because of the legal training that we have is sometimes dangerous to your faith, because it causes you to, you know, we're taught to question every single thing and debate every issue. And if you can't connect every single dot along the way, then it falls logically and in every other way. And frankly, Mike, there was a period of my journey which because of that training caused me to, you know, I had some dark times. And then I finally came to a different understanding, and the different understanding is, for me personally, my goodness, no, that's not right. I don't need to know the answer to every single question. There are mysteries of our faith that I am not going to know the answer to on this side of eternity. I expect revelation of that on the other side of eternity, but not now. That's not a failure of my faith. That's the definition of faith. And so it's less rigid, but certainly I you know, have a faith in God. I have a relationship with Jesus Christ, who I believe is deity, and I believe that I must experience that through all of the things that you mentioned. I think corporate worship is important. I think exploring that through friendships and acquaintances today and every single day are important, and casually, not wearing it on your sleeve. This very day, I had an acquaintance of mine just out of the blue start asking me some questions, some philosophical questions that had to do with God and the divine and whatever. Well, I don't know why that happened today. I've known him for 10 years. We've never had such a conversation. I have to believe that God put that on his heart today. That's just an opportunity that's presented to you. Do I have all the answers? Do I have the rigid understanding of what I think it looks like I thought I used to? I do not. I know I have a Redeemer. I know that my faith is in that, and I know that I have a future in him, what it looks like. I just don't know anymore. I like to debate it. I like to talk about it, but I'm not rigid.
Yeah, well, and you're okay with not knowing, is what I hear you saying, which I think is a good place to be and a hard place to get to sometimes. Tell me about, you've spent, I mean, you grew up in a denomination, in an institutional church, you know, Catholics, Methodists, you know, Baptist, whatever. What is the future of institutional church? I don't know if you're, you have four wonderful kids. I don't know if they're all following in the same church you and Debbie go to or doing different things, but so many kids are tackling institutional church today very differently. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so my kids are all finding their own way. They're all different. I think there will always be a place for an institutional congregation. I think just like everything about society, culture, and everything else, it's going to look a lot differently than we anticipate. You know, even with the, you know, we're all been hit with COVID, and I've attended church online for a year. Never thought I would do that in my entire life, but it's the new reality just because of COVID. But I think it's also how all of it is going to evolve. And I don't know that I can predict what it's going to look like in the future. I do think, though, that there will always be a form of institutional congregations, because I think it's intended. I think it's biblical. I think it's it goes back to what I said before. The important things in life are friends and community, and friends, community, and family as it relates to your relationship with God. And you put all those together, even if it's four people, even if it's 10 people, even if it's 20, or if it happens to be a mega church, all of that is part of what I think was the intended God design, to have us rely on one another, to interact with one another in a human way, and provide each other support and encouragement. That's the human way. I need to visit with my friends occasionally and receive encouragement. I need to encourage them. And so I think that's what's going to happen.
Mm. Yeah, well stated, well put. Let me give you some kind of quick popcorn questions. I'm going to ask you to kind of wrap us up with one more global question. So on the quicker popcorn questions, favorite biblical figure other than Jesus, who would that be and why?
Well, I suppose it's the go-to, or maybe the trite answer, but look, the command of Scripture was to, if you want to keep your life, lose it. If you want to be success as a Christian, then it's about sacrifice. I mean, Jesus didn't preach that you would be a success in this life. He preached, in fact, just the opposite. And so Paul is the example to me of that person that fulfilled that directive that I sure as heck have never been able to fulfill. I might aspire to it, but I never have, and I don't suspect I ever will. And for that reason, my goodness, he left everything and gave up everything in his devotion to Jesus Christ.
Mm. Favorite book of the Bible, New or Old Testament, and why?
Revelation, because it's so intriguing, so mysterious, so I can't get my brain around it. What does that mean? And so about the future. And I just am intrigued about what the next chapter is, whether that's tomorrow or 10 years or 20 years from now, or what the next life looks like. Don't pretend to understand it, but wow, is it exciting and intriguing to read.
Mm. A spiritual book that you've read lately that you've recommended or will be recommending to others?
Oh, this may be too political. I don't know. Maybe not a book, but Mike, I'm a big John Pavlovich fan. He's a progressive Christian, and particularly from what's really maybe important about why he's so intriguing to me is because I came from that evangelical background, and he is rightly so very critical of my former ilk and evangelicals, and he's really impressed me. And so I read his material often, well, every day.
Mm-hmm. Don't know that name, but Brian McLaren, I don't know if you've read his stuff, has a similar background, evangelical, and now more on the progressive side and more critiquing the old evangelical church. But interesting. Not your father, but a spiritual mentor. Has there been one spiritual mentor that's kind of been critical to you over the years?
Nobody would know him, but it's personal to me. I mentioned to you growing up in that church, there were, 20 pastors on staff. All of them had their warts and failures and hypocrisy because they were human. But there was a young man that was brought on the staff there. His name was Herb Hubbard. And he was the young couple's pastor. I was a newly married. And he was at the church for a number of years. And then, like many of them, was promoted to his own congregation and then moved on. And mostly like everybody, I went through a really dark and some difficult times about 15 or 20 years ago. And there was really nobody to reach out to. My dad had passed away. He didn't know anything to me. He had been my pastor for 3 or 4 years. He was in Savannah, Georgia at the time. I reached out to him, and boy, did he respond. And sacrifice and spent time and walked me through those dark times when he didn't have any obligation to do so or any need. He was being what a true pastor should be. Mm-hmm. And anecdotally and quite coincidentally, today, out of the clear blue from Savannah, Georgia,
he called you
and just said, "Hey, just checking on my buddy. How you doing? Anything I can do for you today?"
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you and I are about the same age. I hope we got a good 20, 30 years left. But if for some strange reason this was your last night and you just had a minute or two to tell others what you think is most important, what would you say?
Call your kids every night, even if they're adults, or text them, tell them you love them, tell them you're praying for them, and tell them you're there for them. That's what lasts.
Outstanding. Excellent. Tim Dollar, thank you so much for your time. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you.